In the musical South Pacific, there is a satirical song penned by Roger Hammerstein titled "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught." The piece is a commentary on the prejudices that we pass down from generation to generation and speaks to the cultural challenges that are addressed in the context of the play. It is a warning to watch our words and our behavior, for our children learn their values from the way we live. In the song, Lieutenant Cable sings, "You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught." And it's true, isn't it? For better or for worse, we are formed by the beliefs and practices of those nearest and dearest to us, those who form us in our childhood and adolescence. Their daily words, their daily actions bear far more weight on the people we become than official classes or lessons or instruction. We learn our sense of character from those we watch, and our behavior, therefore, ought to match our rhetoric. In this fourth chapter of Ephesians, Paul is calling the church to have a character that matches its rhetoric. For the first three chapters of this letter, Paul has been outlining this theological claim for the new community formed by Christ's cross and this new life they have experienced together, all these people, through his death and his resurrection. In the fourth chapter, though, Paul does what any good theologian should do. He moves from the world of philosophical thought to the world of pragmatic action. Theology without practice is a worthless venture. And so here we turn to the very real ways that the community of Christians are to embody the theology that they profess. Now that you have the theology, you've got to be carefully taught how to live it. And what is outlined here, I think, is extraordinary. For each piece of wisdom that we read in this passage today begins with a renunciation of a way of life that is not in accordance with a moral life, a turning away from hate and fear, to borrow Hammerstein's lyric. And then it bypasses what we might conclude using our own sense of morality, our own values, through some logical way of thinking that we in some secular way could just be a good person. It bypasses where we might go there and then pushes us beyond what we would think is reasonable to a way of life that could only possibly be a God-inspired reality. Let me show you what I'm talking about. The first thing we read in the passage this morning is that the Christians are to put away lying. So first, there's the renunciation. You're renouncing, you're turning away from lying. Practical wisdom would tell us that's a good thing to do in most cases, being a truth teller. Honest speech promotes unity and trust. But Paul pushes the community past the place of practical wisdom. Because practical wisdom would say, could argue, that we should speak the truth at all times, no matter the consequences, even if it hurts. Truth and practical wisdom can be practiced devoid of love. Here, though, Paul tells the church that they are to speak the truth because you belong to each other. You speak the truth out of love and respect and mutual need for one another. So the truth is always, therefore, in service of a deeper love that binds the community together. It isn't truth-telling for the good it can do for you. It's truth-telling that is to serve the unity of the community. The second renunciation we encounter in our passage today is that of anger. It's not actually a renunciation of anger, which it's in its very nature, not renouncing anger could be against our practical wisdom when we tell folks to just let it go or don't get worked up. Instead, here we hear that anger is okay, a righteous anger. This is the kind of anger that is kindled when we encounter injustice or hateful language or abuse or neglect. This anger is akin to God's wrath, for we should not be in people who are indifferent to the suffering we see in the world. Now, practical wisdom might tell us that when something makes us angry, we should cut ourselves off from it or from someone who makes us angry. Or if we see an injustice that gets us worked up, let's just write a small check so that we can appease our conscience and move on. But Paul again pushes the church past the place of perhaps where our practical wisdom would lead us. He says, "Be angry without sinning and do not let the sun go down on your anger." Or to quote Paul in his letter to the Romans, "If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." Paul pushes the Christian community not to stay mired in its anger and not to take vengeful action, but to work towards reconciliation. We do not let our anger possess us, but move us towards reconciliation that works towards the peace of all people. The third thing Paul addresses in these verses is stealing. There's a twofold argument here. First, we are literally not to go and take things from other people that don't belong to us. Practical wisdom would tell us as much. We want to live in a world where people get to keep what they earn and that we can trust that what we earn, we're going to get to keep for ourselves and someone else won't claim it as theirs. But there's another layer to this command. Instead of simply speaking about petty theft, I don't think there was just like a rampant outbreak of petty theft in the church in Ephesus that Paul needed to address. Instead, I think Paul is talking here about honest work. Work, Paul says, is a means to do good, both through the practice of our vocation and through the use of the wages we earn for doing our vocation. How often do we see our work as something that we endure in order that we can do the thing we really want to do? Or how often we leave our morals at the door in the workplace and we do whatever is necessary to get ahead? Paul says that for the Christian, each day of work is to be viewed as an opportunity to do good for others. That's both through the workday hours that you're in your workplace and with the earnings that you garner for the work that you do. You use those for the good of those who do not have as well. We work not for ourselves or for money, but for the good we can offer to others. And then finally, Paul turns to foul words. It isn't just lying that seems to be the problem. It's frivolous speech, gossip, slander, backbiting, crudeness. We're to renounce those as well. Now, practical wisdom might stop there. Who here hasn't grown up hearing the phrase, "If you can't say anything nice"? But that's not enough for the Christian. We are to speak, but we are to choose words that build up the community. We are to use our speech to dispense grace. So that is what we must be carefully taught, to exchange lying for truth-telling that's not self-serving, but brings the community together, to exchange anger for reconciliation that does not ignore the suffering of the world, to exchange thievery or a view of work as something to be avoided for an understanding of vocation that our work is an opportunity to do God's good in the world and our wages are an opportunity to give to those who do not have. And finally, we're to exchange frivolous speech, not for silence, but for words that build others up. There's a common bond between these four practical elements of living this theology of resurrection, and all of them are concerned with the life of our neighbor. Each of these instructions to the church calls us to look beyond ourselves to how we are serving and building up the body of Christ. It is a call to living in a way that teaches others what it means to have been clothed with the new life that Christ brings us. And that life is marked first and foremost by a willingness to consider how our personal lives are affecting and influencing for God the lives that are around us. How does our truth speech build others up? How does our anger lead to reconciliation and new ways of living in community? How does our work help others who need assistance? How do our words encourage? Paul makes it very clear at the end of the passage, the Christian life is ultimately about imitating Jesus, which means we have to give ourselves away, just as he gave himself away for the world. It is by a life committed to the good of the neighbor that we ultimately teach future generations what it means to follow Jesus. As a middle-aged composer, Roger Hammerstein, that lyricist who wrote that song in South Pacific, befriended a 10-year-old playmate of his son, a young boy who would go on to become America's most loved and prolific musical theater composers, Stephen Sondheim. It was Hammerstein who taught, cultivated, and instilled in the young Sondheim a love for musical theater. One of Sondheim's most popular musicals became a movie in the past year, Into the Woods. In the show, characters from traditional fairy tales are sent on quests, and they bump into one another. Little Red Riding Hood, Jack and his Beanstalk, Cinderella, Rapunzel, and others play into a drama of a baker and his wife who are trying to reverse a curse placed on their house so that they might have a child. Each of these stories, these fairy tales, were originally composed to teach children moral lessons about how to live in the world. And each of those stories coalesce in the final scene of the first act, and so we end up in this moment of extreme bliss as Act One comes to a close. In the second act of the play, however, everyone's preconceived notions of what happily ever after is fall apart. You begin to question who in this show is the good guy and who is the bad guy, who can be trusted, who cannot be trusted, and why does unspeakable tragedy happen to people who are trying to do what is right? Going into the woods is actually leaving the safety and the security of our neat and clean fairy tales and stepping out into the messiness that is real human life. And finally, at the end of the show, as families are broken and new relationships are forming, a town is destroyed, and no one is quite sure how things will go from here, one of the main protagonists of the play, the witch, steps out on the stage and sings to the audience a song composed by Sondheim, a commentary on how we live our beliefs with integrity, a song that beautifully complements and plays upon the themes of his mentor and his teacher, Roger Hammerstein. How do you say to a child in the night, nothing's all black, but then nothing's all white? How do you say it will all be all right when you know that it mightn't be true? What do you do? Careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. children will look to you for which way to turn, to learn what to be. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. Careful the wish you make. Wishes are children. Careful the path they take. Wishes come true. Not free. Careful the spell you cast, not just on children. Sometimes that spell may last past what you can see and turn against you. Careful the tale you tell, that is the spell. Children will listen. How can you say to a child who's in flight, don't slip away and I won't hold so tight? What can you say that no matter how slight won't be misunderstood? What do you leave to your child when you're dead? Only whatever you put in his head. Things that your father and mother have said that were left to them too. Careful what you say. Children will listen. Careful you do it too. Children will see and learn. Guide them, but step away. Children will glisten. Tamper with what is true, and children will turn, if just to be free. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. Children will listen. Children will listen. You've got to be carefully taught in order to be clothed with Christ, so that our lives might bear witness to all life, who we are, and what we believe. For our children will listen.